You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Jess Mitten back with John Tucker, and we have in our interactive broker studio, June Grasso, Bloomberg News legal analyst and host of Bloomberg Law here. And we're also going to bring in our star equities reporter, Bailey Lipschultz. He's here in, he's in Zoom in New Jersey.
Oh, I was going to say, where is he? He's not here.
He's always here, though, so it's fine.
I don't think so, Bailey.
He's our star reporter.
Give him grief. He's working from home.
We're going to talk about the next legal steps in the criminal case against former President Donald Trump. Also, how these Trump leaks facts that you were talking about, John, earlier have been reacting this. So, June, I'm going to start off with you. Can you set the scene to just run down what's happened and what is ahead for this as far as when we're going into next week?
So, do you have a half hour?
So many pieces to unpack.
I actually do.
You do? Okay, that's good. So, the main thing is that we don't know what the charges are because it's under seal. So we won't find out what the charges actually are, perhaps until the arraignment itself happens on Tuesday. But what we suspect and what's been reported, as John Tucker knows, is that it's supposed to be a falsifying business records charge, which is a misdemeanor. And in order to take that up to a felony, the prosecutors will have to prove that Trump falsified records to cover up a second crime, such as violating federal campaign finance law. So that's what we suspect it is. That's a novel kind of theory. New York prosecutors have never tried that before. And as far as the arraignment, which comes next, is that he's going to be here downtown at
this is New York Criminal Court. If you've ever been to arraignments, and I've been to any, not me, but watching others being arraigned, it's an assistant district attorney who's like 25 years old, and they power through it. Like, your arraignment, if you're just a typical Joe or Joan, takes about 20 seconds.
So
I suspect it's going to be different.
Okay. Especially if they read the 30-count, what CNN's reporting is a 30-count indictment, it will be longer. And I don't know for sure, but I think it might not be the 25-year-old assistant, you know.
Oh, you think Bragg's going to do it?
No, I don't know that Bragg is going to do it, but I think maybe one of the attorneys that's been working on this case might do it. So just for, you know. So we might actually get a shot of Donald Trump in the hallway. They sometimes allow cameras in the hallway. So if he's walked into the courtroom through the hallway, we might actually see him.
That'll be the perp walk that we usually get.
Yeah, I don't think he'll be in handcuffs unless he wants to be. He has said, there's been talk apparently about him wanting to have a perp walk with handcuffs on. But so he'll be, and you won't see, he'll be booked in the DA's office, he'll be fingerprinted, the mugshot will be taken, maybe a DNA swab, I'm not sure about that. And we won't see those mugshots, most likely, unless some news organization says we need to see them under First Amendment grounds for some reason, I don't know what. So that's what will happen, and then the charges will be read, and he'll plead not guilty, and he'll get to go home to Florida.
Okay, with your background, and I have to point out to everybody, we are talking to a Harvard Law School graduate who's got extensive experience. Is this case flimsy?
I can't say.
I mean, having not seen the charges.
Because I haven't seen the charges. I mean, everyone is waiting. Every lawyer is waiting to see what the charges are, you know, once that indictment is unsealed, to see if maybe there's more there than we thought. But let me just say this. I don't think that Alvin Bragg, who's a cautious kind of man, would indict a former president if he couldn't, if he didn't think he could prove his case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Wait a second. I remember talking to the chief judge of New York, Saul Wachler, and he told me, in New York, you can indict a ham sandwich.
Yes, but this is not a ham sandwich.
A few years later.
No, but this is not a ham sandwich that we're indicting. This is a former president, and you don't want to indict him just because you can indict him. And so, look at what he went through with the grand jury. I mean, he called witness after witness. He called witnesses for the defense to the grand jury. Then he called rebuttal witnesses. So, I mean, I think there might be more there.
Let's bring in Bailey to get the take what's happening with these SPACs that have been linked to Donald Trump. What's happening today? How have they been performing?
Yeah, right now we have Digital World, which is the SPAC, working to take Trump Media Group public, is up about 8%. So trading around $14. Remember, SPACs typically go public around $10. This one has a little bit more than $10 per share in cash value. So still trading at a 30% premium, 30% and change premium to what it would be worth if this deal fell apart, really is just a gauge or a proxy of how much news is around Trump and how much excitement could be around it. So you see Digital World trading higher. You see Rumble, which is the conservative alternative to YouTube, actually reported earnings and was up double digits. Funware is a penny stock that's tied to Trump, also rallying, but still really down sharply over the past year. So those are the big three proxies that pretty much get a bid, whether it's good news or bad news or really any news as it relates to the former president. We typically see these stocks really move in tandem.
So what's the idea? It's everybody's going to be watching these outlets. I don't even know what to call them because 24 hours, 7 days a week now.
That's the view. Trump Media owns Truth Social, so kind of his ripoff of Twitter, which is where he typically posts. So we've seen engagement, pretty strong numbers relatively from there. So that's kind of part of the optimism, is that if Trump is making headlines and if you are a follower or just interested in what he's doing, you're going to be spending more time on Truth Social, maybe going on to Rumble to hear Russell Brand or some other commentators who have been booted or banned from various platforms, kind of laying out their expectations. Rumble's a company that really wants to be uncancelable, is the way they phrase it. So those are kind of areas that, at least the perception is, that if you're not wanting to listen to Bloomberg Radio or other traditional media outlets, that's where you'll kind of go for your entertainment engagement sounding boards.
And Bailey, you cover all things SPACs. What's next for this Trump-tied SPAC moving forward?
They've been working to get this deal done. This was a deal announced back in October 2021. They've really done everything they can to get extensions. So right now, their drop-dead date is in September. So that means they can continue to work on getting the sign-off from the likes of the Justice Department, the SEC, who have been helping hold up this deal. So all eyes are on what could move forward. One thing that's interesting to note, though, a few weeks ago, their CEO actually was booted from his role, Patrick Orlando, who had brought public a handful of SPACs and was really a big fan of Donald Trump. So the shaking up at Digital World with their new CEO, Eric Swider, stepping into that role could be a cause for optimism that this deal will eventually get done. But I talked to a lot of people in the SPAC industry, and they still really see this as something that probably does not actually cross the finish line, which would mean investors who bought it at $14 today or $175 back in October 2021 will be left with about $10.35.
This is unfair because I haven't seen the financials of any of these companies. I mean, are they really viable?
There's a lot of the beauty and curse of SPACs is that we don't really know much about what Trump Media wants to be or what it plans to be. Rumble valuation is really the big thing that analysts are kind of skittish of, but they have seen an ability to court some of these, call them talent or influencers, to their platform. So I think that Rumble, it seems like, at least looking at the fundamentals, could serve as a alternative video platform, but there's a lot of gray area around the valuation of Trump Media and actually what it would look like and whether it could ever turn a profit.
And June, before you go, since you're still billing us, we're What are your billable hours anyway?
For when you, it, when is you're the arraignment? An influencer
is,
to me.
Do we know? Is it Tuesday? Wednesday?
Tuesday. When? It's supposed to be Tuesday. We're hearing 2:15.
Oh, okay. We're hearing from whom?
Well,
that's your sources.
The,
general,
it's out there. His attorneys have been talking, and so he's supposedly coming in on Monday night if you want to go to Trump Tower to greet him, John. And then Tuesday, he'll be down at the criminal courthouse.
Excellent. And you'll be there too, I suspect. Thank you. June Grasso.
My pleasure.
Bailey Lipschitz.
My pleasure.
It's great having you both here. June Grasso, Bloomberg News legal analyst, and Bailey Lipschitz, U.S. equities reporter for Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
It's Andy Purdy with Huawei USA. He's the chief security officer. Going to help us detail some of the company's 2022 financial reports, some of the particulars there. Andy, thanks for being on the program. You're in Washington. Give us some of the highlights of what the report says.
Well, we have been in a difficult situation for a couple of years, and we're pleased that our business has stabilized and we are in a position to move forward. We are finding tremendous success in our 5G2B business, and we're investing historic amounts of money, in this case, 25.1% of our revenue, over $23 billion in R&D, to help us deal with the recent unpleasantries and to help us find, working with partners, the path forward to help grow our business.
Hey, Andy, unpack this latest report for us. What were the biggest takeaways?
Well, the overall revenue increased slightly. Our carrier business had a slight increase. Our enterprise business did tremendous, up 30%. And that's really around our 5G2B, our digitalization. Right now, we work with 700 cities in the world, 267 of the Fortune Global 500 companies under digital strategy. We've got 9 million developers and 40,000 ecosystem partners. And we're also announcing results of individual additional units. For example, in digital power and cloud, those are important areas for us that we look forward to driving some real progress in the years ahead.
Hey, you're a subsidiary of Huawei Technologies, which we all know is the largest maker of telecom equipment. The launch of sort of a new social control era in China focuses on technology, tracking technology, whatever you want to call it at this point. And you have been scrutinized on Capitol Hill, not unlike what we saw with TikTok. What is happening on that front when it comes to the regulatory capacity in Congress?
Well, the two major areas. One has to do with our ability to do business in the United States, and it's clear the United States is not interested in allowing us to do business in the United States. So that's a reality. We're not going to complain about it. We're going to move forward. The other is the question of trade restrictions, the ability of American companies to sell non-sensitive technologies to us. And while I applaud the efforts under the CHIPS Act to bring a lot of jobs to America, you know, the fact is I'm concerned about American jobs in the semiconductor industry, their ability to sell non-sensitive technologies to us. I think it could be a difficult future, and I hope there might be a way to allow the sale of such non-sensitive technologies to us.
And when it comes to these security issues, what did you find had the most red flags?
Well, the issues over a number of years, and there really has not been anything specific. Obviously, there have been some geopolitical concerns. And so what we have tried to do around the world, in the European Union, in Germany, and all around the world, is we try to develop and maintain the trust of our customers and the trust of the folks they have to deal with, their particular governments. We're a supplier, they're an operator. And so we have worked very hard on our global cybersecurity and privacy assurance program, on partnering with standards bodies, on partnering, for example, with the telecom equipment effort that the standards bodies form to create specific requirements for telecom companies, specific testing requirements and accountability requirements. All those things we find gives the ability for most of the countries in the world to be able to push back and say, no, there isn't a problem with Huawei. We take cybersecurity seriously. We take privacy seriously. And frankly, as I hear all this commotion, I hope the United States is going to take privacy protection a whole lot more seriously than we have in the past. National privacy legislation will be good, but that's not going to be good enough to help address the risk involving, for example, social media companies.
Well, how much of what Huawei does around the world relates to governments keeping tabs on their people?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, the issue of surveillance is not something that we do. There's.
But I mean, supplying the components to enable that.
Well, the issues about what products you sell that could be misused, and draw a very rough analogy, the idea of a hammer can be used for good, it can be used for bad. We don't help governments create special algorithms or special technologies that they can use to abuse people. We are working globally to participate in the development of ethical principles for some of these things that go beyond the issue of complying with the individual requirements in individual countries. And we think those kinds of efforts are what's going to be necessary to help address the risk of misuse by governments. And there's definitely a risk there.
Is there a path back into the United States?
There is so much business to do around the world, so many places where people right now are anxious for us to do business. So we are not really pursuing the possibility of doing business in the United States. And frankly, I'm glad that at least we can share some of the lessons we're learning about how countries and companies, how governments can benefit from the new technology, so that hopefully the United States, not with us, but hopefully the United States can ramp up their efforts to get the benefits of these technologies and to grow the competitiveness of America. And one of the great shortcomings has to do with our talent, our workforce, because we're really not stepping up for the future.
Andy, you brought up government legislation earlier. What do you think specifically needs to be in that with regards to privacy?
Well, I think we've seen some recent examples of what shouldn't be in there. And I defer to the privacy experts as to what, and the industry experts as to what should be in privacy legislation. But I think there need to be more than those kinds of requirements, because the minimal requirements that you can get legislatures to agree on are not going to be good enough, given the risk, given one of the lessons we learned 2 years ago with these major cyber attacks on trusted American companies, SolarWinds and Microsoft Exchange Server, prove there's no such thing as trusted suppliers. They're trusted, but the bad guys can hack into them. So whoever's got data, whoever has important functions, and as we move into 5G-enabled technologies, automation, machine-to-machine communication, sensor-to-machine, we have to make sure that those systems are going to be running. So we have to make sure that no matter who the supplier is, there are objective and transparent basis for knowing whether those products and services, whether those data are protected. And I think the leaders of cybersecurity in the United States are moving in the right direction, but we've got to really ramp up those efforts to promote assurance, transparency, and accountability.
What is the future hold for your company in terms of technology?
Well, right now, the proof case of the 5G to business, the digitalization of industries and sub-industries, is so exciting. And the benefits of smart mining and ports and manufacturing, the efforts that we're working with the major carriers in the world to help reduce the carbon footprint, to help meet the UN goals, we are actively participating in how to generate green energy, how to transport it, how to save it, how to increase the efficiency of everything that's done, and find ways to use more green energy. And so the future is very, very bright, particularly with the strong partners that we have around the world.
And you're talking about green energy. What specifically are those strategies whenever you were talking to how to improve all of this?
Well, you have some existing technologies that you want them to be more efficient. So, for example, in the carrier networks, data centers and base stations, kind of like antennas, use up a lot of energy. So using technology, sometimes with algorithms, to try to take advantage of when they're not being used to reduce the power consumption. And in terms of whether they're stored outside or inside, whether you have to use air conditioning, those kinds of techniques can increase efficiency and can promote a reduction in the carbon footprint. And the fact is that hardcore research and development, working with our partners to try to develop green energy and how to bring it forward, how to find ways to to deliver power that's based on green energy is something that we're working hard on, and we're making substantial progress on. It's exciting to be part of that.
You mentioned smart mining. What? Give me the dummy's definition, me being the dummy of smart mining.
So, for example, you know how drone pilots can don't have to be on the battlefield. So increasingly, and we've got a number of examples in Africa and China and other places where you create special 5G, special power requirements. There can be 5G underground. So you can have the sensors, you can have the machines so that they can control the equipment without going down in the mines. There's one mine my colleague told me about, he visited, that's 3,000 meters underground. And the working shift for the workers is 4 weeks. They have to go down there for 4 weeks. So the idea of having this technology that can allow not only the operations, but the monitor of safety. So you have like a 30 meter giant machine that's doing the mining, and you have multiple cameras to monitor them. So you use an AI algorithm to stitch together the videos along that 30 meter strip so that the operator can monitor it, and you can have and those who are providing oversight for safety and control and resilience, they can monitor it also. It's the same thing with the ports. The ability to have automation can increase efficiency and help cut down on some of the supply chain bottlenecks are there. And manufacturing generally, the greater efficiency of the manufacturing process is going to save money and reduce energy consumption. And this stuff is all very exciting.
Andy, thanks a lot. Andy Purdy, Huawei's USA Chief Security Officer, detailing some of the financial report of the company's 22 financial results. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week right here on Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So we've got another great guest in our lineup. So Kathy Kraninger, and she's the former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, also vice president of regulatory affairs at Solid Labs. She's on Zoom from Washington, D.C. And so,
How do you pronounce that? Solidus?
Correct.
Solidus. Okay. Excuse me. Solidus.
Sorry to correct you on
Sorry
the air,
to butcher
Jess.
That, but we corrected it. So Solidus Labs. So to give some context to our listeners, it's a crypto market surveillance firm that works with exchanges, regulators, and investment firms to flag market manipulation and other risk issues. And so, Kathy, I want you to break this down for us, because obviously we've had the wake of multiple bank collapses. We've also had FTX in recent months. What happened with that situation? It's still ongoing, obviously. Right, but then how exactly has all this ended up impacting the crypto market specifically?
It has a dramatic impact. Look, I believe in the future of the digital asset space. I think it's the future of the internet. That's why I joined this industry, and I'm excited to be, you know, wearing a white hat at Solidus Labs, which, as you noted, you know, looks for manipulation and seeks to root out fraud in this space. But the news of FTX, the tentacles that FTX had across the globe to regulators, to policymakers, it was looked at as a leader in some respects in the conversation around what regulation and what responsible market participants should do. And you see that it was a big scam. And as you noted, additional charges were brought this week, and more keeps coming on that. But look, fraud is not new, and certainly digital asset markets did not invent it. You see this in traditional finance. There are regular enforcement actions against the biggest banks and institutions, you know, in financial services on a not infrequent basis. And also there are scammers who are always going to seek to take advantage of people unfairly. And the hope is that prosecutors go after them. And to the fullest extent of the law, They managed to claw back funds and make people who were hurt whole.
In the crypto space, am I correct to say it's the platforms where all the hookiness has been taking place?
Like the platforms perform an important role to the extent that you've got intermediaries in the space. Of course, one of the promises and directions of digital asset markets is decentralization. So you don't always necessarily have to have that intermediary in the middle. But look, many of us don't want to manage our own wallets individually and understand, you know, the details of the security that would be needed to engage directly in the space. So you're going to have platforms in the future. And some of the core issues are really around what these underlying assets are, and then therefore which regulatory structure is required of them. There is still a requirement around transparency and fairness and disclosure, and many of the good market participants in this space are doing that to the best of their ability, complying with the law that, you know, applies to them, using capabilities like we provide at Solidus Labs. But there are also those that are not doing that.
Oh, and I got to ask the obligatory question. Is this a currency or a commodity? I mean, who's the regulator? Gary Gensler wants to be.
John, you're getting to the heart of the matter. That is part of the challenge. I do fundamentally believe that digital assets are not just of one nature. It's not one type of asset. And so the question of, you know, what is it, is, you know, an asset by asset assessment. It is not, you know, foreign to lawyers who are looking at those things that are, you know, instruments in traditional finance. You know, there are clear rules around securities. We talk a lot about the Howey test and the Reeves test, but those need to be applied. And the platforms are saying we're applying those tests. And Chairman Gensler is saying, you know, I don't think so. So there's a lot to be worked out, definitely in the courts on that front. That is completely separate from, you know, fraud and bad actors. Wanted to make sure I said that pretty clearly.
And what are your thoughts on Senator Elizabeth Warren in her position on crypto? Because I know that the Senate obviously has a particular stance on the market regulation, but what's going on there and how do you see all of that playing out?
Like, I think Congress needs to engage in the space and members need to be educated and understand the technology, think through the best way to put a specific regulatory framework into place. I'm one of the people that believes Congress needs to act on that front. And so you have members that are really engaged and have spent the time. You know, Senators Lummis and Gillibrand had a bipartisan bill they issued last year. They're working on it again and going to reissue that this year. You have leadership on the House Financial Services Committee, too, that is excited about, trying to tackle the issues around stablecoins and market structure. The agriculture committees in the House and the Senate, too, really engaging in this space. So there are going to be a lot of different perspectives. And I just fundamentally believe, as I said, that the future of the internet and the future of so many things about how our economy can operate, innovate, and be accessible for the future, it is in this technology, but there are risks, and those need to be weighed, as does the right regulatory regime.
Where are we in the regulatory front? I mean, in a nutshell, is it happening?
It's happening through the courts. That's likely.
Well, that's not really regulation. That's more like, you got to do this, guys, or else.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part about this. You're seeing it through enforcement actions from the SEC and the CFTC. Some of them clearly designed to try to put the bounds around crypto assets and define them as securities or commodities, but not in a direct way, not by issuing notice and comment regulation. And that's where you get to Congress too, because in some respects, Congress needs to solve some of these issues. But you do also have the SEC issuing regulations around custody that encompass certainly many aspects of traditional finance, but also encompass crypto assets too.
I mean, is the industry welcoming all this? I mean, they were obviously, you know, one of the reasons for being is to avoid that or not be regulated or whatever. Do they now welcome it or what?
the industry has been pretty consistent, although it is hard with decentralization to talk about it as one industry. But to be clear, those who are the platforms that you mentioned earlier, John, and the those that are in intermediaries in the space, they know they have regulatory responsibilities under current law. They know there are regulatory responsibilities that need to be shaped and take into account the differences with these assets and the differences with these markets. And so that's something that, you know, we've put forth as the industry a lot of different ideas around this and do want to see Congress act and do want to see the SEC and the CFTC engage.
What do you think is the most realistic way to try to address fraud? Because we've seen so many instances and scandals, as you know, especially even in recent months in the crypto world.
It is incredibly disheartening. There's no other way to say it. And some of it is just, you know, unfortunately, the nature of anything that's new. You know, you noted I was the director of the CFPB. The types of scams and frauds that you know, really go after vulnerable populations, you know, they're constant. So they're not unique to digital assets. But I see an opportunity, and we see it in our ability at Solidus to identify rug pulls. We can preclude those bad actors from at all benefiting from and getting the funds off-ramped out of the blockchain ecosystem. So therefore, completely disincentivizing deploying the scam to begin with. And so those are some of the things that the technology can really facilitate. You know, they deploy a token, you can only buy, you can't actually sell, you can't get out of it. And then, you know, the person who actually deployed that does a rug pull, pulls all the funds, and then escapes with those funds. If you can identify that as a rug pull and stop them from escaping with the funds, there's no benefit then in deploying the scams to begin with. And that's something this technology facilitates.
I have a reverse barometer. whenever people talk about it at the barbershop, I run. And that's all they were talking about it a few years ago, crypto. Kathy, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. That was interesting. Kathy Kraniger, the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs at Solidus Laboratories. They work with the exchanges and presumably on the regulatory front as well. You are listening to Bloomberg Radio.
You know what, JT? I'm very excited about our next guest because this is a company that's female-run by their strategy. So we have Stephanie Blake, the Chief Executive Officer of Skylight Studios on Zoom from Petaluma, California. No, you're still invited. We're not going to kick you out, JT. And so, Stephanie, I hear you're taking old iconic buildings and turning them into something cool. Tell us about what Skylight Studio is and what you do.
Hi, yeah. So Skylight, we are a placemaking and venue development and management firm, and we focus on adaptive reuse. We were founded actually in 2008, so similar times, if not potentially worse, for commercial real estate. But for us, we drive creative revenue streams and new uses to often historic or underutilized properties by bringing in brands, Fortune 100 companies, to do experiences, to foster sort of a new way of gathering and entertainment. And we've been doing it for the last 15 years. Looking from the High Line to Moynihan Station, the Ferry Building in San Francisco, Ghirardelli Square, Detroit. So that is what we've been doing, and I think see a ton of opportunity right now.
Stephanie, let me paint the picture for you. Where are we? 58th and Lexington.
59th and Lex, yeah.
Okay.
So I don't know where I am. look out the window. Well, look downstairs. There used to be a Starbucks, remember, in this building. There was an H&M on the first floor, gone. The Container Store is gone.
There's Victoria, a chocolate store there now instead of the Starbucks, I believe.
Well, Matt Miller thinks it's a front for something else. There's a Victoria's Secret that's gone. What is the state of commercial real estate from where you sit?
Yeah, from where we sit, I think that there's often a trend. You know, I think, what was it now? As of 10 years and change ago, retail was in question. What is the future? What is the future of the ground floor? I think right now with, you know, COVID having accelerated the question mark of a lot of these traditional uses, what gets you out the door? What is the use of the built environment? Do you need to go to work? I think that's the question mark that's happening. And I think a lot of the transactions that have sort of been the foundation of commercial real estate with Fortune 100 tenants, expecting them to continue, where office was not a question. Everyone needs to go to work. Everyone needs a place to go. With that in question, in combination with how retail has continued to evolve, I think that there's an opportunity now to really rethink how people are using space, how people come and interact, and why. And I think that's where we're seeing this convergence of a venue being the new anchor of development, where you can put F&B that rotates. It can enable you to welcome the future by thinking about how, you know, an entertainment concept might be paired with a retail concept, paired with culinary. And I think that's the future, is this collaborative approach to space.
Tell us more about how you're working with landlords.
Yeah, so we work with landlords in many different ways. Our partnerships with landlords often look like they have space and they're not sure exactly how to create dynamic and vibrant sort of differentiators. So I think the same way that it was always, was it fitness, food, amenity space was what was driving office and tenants back and in the building, and was an important sort of intersection. For us, when we work with landlords now, we come to the table with, how do you think about a venue? How do you think about the negative space in your building, in your corridors, in your outdoor spaces? And what is the programming that's going to not just be a beautifully designed space or have the right food, but how are you going to encourage interaction and encourage sort of using programming and experiences and events to help encourage people to interact and use the space? There's so many amenity spaces now that are being built still and are not being used. And I think that's where we've actually partnered a lot with architects alongside landlords to provide the heartbeat against the design.
Okay. And I think that's... And the challenge is where everybody wants to work from home nowadays. I mean, it's got to be incredibly challenging for you. Do people come to you, landlords, businesses, and say, I want my people back in the office, they don't want to come back, but if you give me some ideas, maybe we can change that? Beer on tap, but that's another story.
And I think, I mean, my early days, I grew up at Google in my
Oh,
early
you
career.
Did have
that it did have you.
Yeah.
But I will say, yes, so that is one challenge, absolutely, that we're brought to all the time. How do we get tenants back? How do we do, you know, is it food? Is it, what is the thing? And I think people have hung their hat on, it's food and fitness. I think the other challenge, or the other way in which we're a solution, is if you design a venue that's used by tenants, example, you know, what we're doing right now at Penn District in the middle of Midtown, or in San Francisco with the auditorium at 345 Montgomery, there's an opportunity to think about a lot of companies who are not coming in daily. When do they come together? They want to come together when they're bringing various departments together, when they have meetings, when they have announcements. And it's interesting because we were, for a very long time, the types of assets we had, when we created a venue, it was often for external purposes. How do we wow our clients? How do we share a product launch? Now it's, how do we actually bring our employees together and be able to show them why do you need to be together? What is the value of being together? And how do we create a meaningful experience? And so there's an opportunity for some of these buildings to be used not just by the tenants, having the amenity where you can bring people together, whether it's a beautiful auditorium, you have programming that's an option that can create different ideas and experiences, but also how do you bring in outside tenants to use the space as well? And I think there's an intersection now where meetings have risen exponentially. Today, I think it's a $260 billion market. By 2026, it's predicted to be a $500+ billion market. And so people are spending to bring their employees together, whether it's in the office or another space. And I think that's the value that you can bring.
And Stephanie, when it comes to higher interest rates, how has that been impacting the real estate environment in your view?
Yeah, I mean, where
and
we
you got
sit,
30 seconds to say it.
Sure. Where we sit, you know, we've been able to come to deals to sort of de-risk the opportunity from whether it's an investment or landlord perspective or a buyer's perspective. Obviously, interest rates will decrease transactions, which is again where you want to be able to bring in the best of many industries to use a space. It cannot just be office and expecting these tenants to come back and sign the 20-year leases. By creating venues, it enables you to use the best of these markets and the best of these industries to come together for meeting space as a catalyst to then enable other tenants to come in and share that space. And I think there's a lot of value in how that can be created.
Did you get the lunch today upstairs?
I did not have time.
You didn't have time.
I didn't have time.
You let that go to waste. It was tuna. It was tuna. Marcus. It was like a tuna. So it was all right. Stephanie okay. Blake. I can't look a gift tuna in the mouth. CEO at Skylight Studios, some unique real estate venue development. Stephanie, thanks a lot. We appreciate it. And you are listening to Bloomberg Radio. It sounds like a jazz station now.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm talking baseball, like Reggie Quisenberry, talking baseball. Carew and Gaylord Perry, Seaver, Garvey, Schmidt, and Bada Blue.
I think we're switching gears now, too.
We are.
I'm guessing baseball.
We are.
Why don't you pick
some
it up?
Some sports. We have, we're going to have Joel Weber here. He's the editor of Bloomberg Business Week here in the interactive.
In the studio? He's not working from home?
No, he's right here with us. He's right here. And then we also are going to have Jerry Smith. He's a media reporter for Bloomberg News on the phone in New York City. So they're going to talk to us about Jerry's latest Bloomberg Business Week story. Watching your favorite team could cost you more than Netflix. So this is really interesting. And I can start off with Jerry first. Break down and just set the scene for this story for us, because I know there's so many people that are interested in this right now.
Sure, yeah, especially with opening day of the baseball season yesterday. We're seeing more and more of these local sports channels that are trying to reach the cord cutters, the people who've canceled their cable subscription. So they are introducing online services that where you can watch baseball, basketball, and hockey in your local market without a cable subscription.
Now, I go back, I'm going to date myself. You guys probably do, too. But I used to watch on PIX, Channel 11 locally.
I was expecting you to say radio.
Well, you could hear it on radio, too. But no, I would watch Phil Rizzuto, Scooter, and Bill White with the Yankee games. Those days are over, I guess, right?
So the money around rights is really what this comes down to, Felix.
This is Joel, by the way.
Thank you. There we go. So the tensions here are between the owners who own the teams and can decide who gets to distribute it. So what's the model when this works? What does it look like? Because what ultimately we're describing here is something that the burden's being put on the fans. But what is everybody vying for here in terms of what the business model can look like?
Okay. So I have to pay $10 for a hot dog, $15 for a beer, and now if I want to watch it, I have to pay up for that.
Yeah, you'll
too.
Pay. But Jerry, who's doing it right?
I think we don't know yet. I think this is all pretty early. I mean, these local sports channels are really way behind in terms of streaming. If you think about Netflix, they started streaming in 2007, and 16 years later, you know, the YES Network, which broadcast the Yankees, finally introduced the streaming service. You know, these are channels that made a ton of money in the old cable business model. Everybody paid for cable. Everybody paid for these channels, even if they never watched a game. And now these channels are trying to build a business outside that cable model. And they're charging $20 or $30 a month in some cases for the service. And really, these are channels, these are online channels that are meant to protect the old business. They're meant to, you know, they're not going to charge $5 or $6 a month because then they're going to upset their distributors, the DirecTVs and the Comcast.
Yeah, but the fans, it's like, I'm not paying this, and I'm just not going to watch the games.
But they are, though.
Oh, they are. All right.
Well, we think. Right?
Maybe I'm not a very good fan then.
I think if you're a real sports fan, you're still subscribing to cable. I mean, that the people who still have cable, they get it for sports, maybe for news. You know, I think this is something for the future where these channels think that there's, you know, cord cutters out there that they can bring back into the fold. But I think that most of the people who want to watch their local sports team are probably already subscribing to cable and continuing to do so.
So the thing with this streaming effort is that it actually is like pretty difficult to get the quality right. What are some of the customers saying about what the experience has been like so far?
Yeah, this is it's a very different challenge than putting a movie or a TV show on a streaming service. Live sports, it's just technically more difficult. You see a lot of examples of streaming services where it'll be the last couple minutes of a game and it'll buffer or the entire
like the game. If you're going to do it right then, yeah?
So I got to pay for this and it doesn't work?
Yeah.
Great.
Pay a lot.
Yeah. I mean, these are cable channels that it's not in their DNA to, they don't have technology people in-house. They have to outsource the work on this. They, you know, they're not like Netflix with an army of engineers who can figure out how to make the stream perfect. So, yeah, we've seen a lot of examples of live.
So when I call customer service at their channel or whatever, they're going to pick up the phone and say, well, I'm sorry, sir, we'll refund you.
Or they'll just outsource that part too. But, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, Jerry, we're having too much fun.
No. I would love to hear what happens when you actually call a customer service at any of these streaming services.
That's assuming they have customer service.
So one of the ones that caught my attention was the Diamond Sports Group, which is actually the largest U.S. owner of local sports channel. But even just this month, they filed for bankruptcy. So what happened there, and what's the aftermath going to look like?
Yeah, so this is... I mean, they are sort of unique because this was four years ago, their owner bought these 19 sports channels and took on a huge amount of debt, over $8 billion in debt, and did so at probably the worst possible time because this is when cord cutting was really starting to accelerate. So you combine having a huge amount of debt with a business that's shrinking pretty quickly. And, you know, they filed for bankruptcy protection a few weeks ago. And it's a really huge story in the sports world because, you know, teams and the players are affected by this. The team owners get a lot of revenue from these local sports rights. And that goes to payroll.
Yeah, that was my next question. How much of these exorbitant salaries that the players get, how does that fold into the mix there?
Yeah, I think that's something to watch. Probably not something we'll see affecting player salaries tomorrow, but in a couple years, if these channels, and a lot of people don't think these teams are ever going to get the kind of money from the sports channels that they did when the cable business was much healthier. So you could see a situation where some of these smaller market teams, and it's really the smaller market teams that are getting pinched by this, they could you know, have trouble paying for the best players. And then you look at you know, Major League Baseball and the haves and the have-nots sort of get wider and wider apart because of this.
So, Jerry, we only have about 40 seconds left, but where does it go from here?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the streaming services, it remains to be seen how many people are willing to pay between $20 and $30 a month. I mean, one of the things to think about is how good are the teams on the field? You know, when your team really stunk, it was still very annoying to call your cable company and cancel. Now, when the team that you're paying $30 a month to stream, if they have a bad season, you can cancel that streaming service in 2 seconds.
And okay. So voting with really, dollars.
Yeah. Gentlemen, great Friday story, by the way. Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber and Bloomberg News media reporter Jerry Smith. Watching your favorite team could cost you more than Netflix. And our ace engineer, Sebastian, reminds me that, yes, Yankees Yes Network does have their own streaming service.
Go Mets.
Now. Yeah. Okay. All right.
I have to sneak that in.
There you go. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio. Bloomberg Business Week, in fact.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
I'm driving in my car.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, this is Jess Minton back with John Tucker, and I'm excited to speak with our next guest, JT. So we have David Dietz, who's managing principal and senior investment strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management. He's on the phone from Summit, New Jersey. And David, I'm glad you're here with us because, as you know, this is the end of what's been a gangbuster first quarter, especially when you're looking at the NASDAQ 100 on pace for its best quarterly gain since 2020 and the second best in the past decade. So I want you to unpack this for us and wrap it up as far as how have you been positioning in the past quarter and what have you been potentially buying the dip on?
Yeah, absolutely. Pleasure to be with you guys this afternoon. So, you know, the Q1, basically what was pounded last year did spectacularly well in this first quarter. So we know the NASDAQ was down 35% last year. It's led the indexes this year up about 20% as it accelerates here at the end of the day. Well, the Dow, which is the best of the three indexes last year, admittedly down, but down less than 10%, is the laggard in the group. It may end up perhaps 1%. So that's one theme. The other theme, of course, is when you start looking at, you know, what sectors did best, it is those NASDAQ sectors, the information technology, the communications group, up, you know, about 10% just this month of March, about 20% for the year. Those sectors were given up for dead, and now, you know, they're off to the races again. Those sectors that did a little bit better last year relative to the overall market really didn't do well, and that may be the opportunity. We'll see. But, you know, the financials are down about 7%. And then you got the energy, utilities, real estate, and surprisingly, healthcare also are down negative for
right.
the quarter.
And you mentioned financials. Have you been buying the dip that we've seen so far the past couple of weeks with the pullback in bank stocks?
So it's a very controversial area. We just don't know what people are thinking, you know, deposits moving in, deposits moving out. But if I had to make one call here, it would be the group of regional banks. Any one bank, they're very opaque. It's very hard to figure out how those deposit flows are going. But I think one thing that investors need to keep in mind is not just a financial issue with those regional banks, it's a political issue. And here's why. You know, you've got politicos in places like South Carolina and Iowa and Ohio. The last thing, ultimately, they want to tell their up-and-coming businesses, if you want a loan, put your tie on and grovel to the big Wall Street banks and hope they hand you some money and spend some time with you. That's not going to work politically. They want too big to fail in each of their states.
Right. So how are you advising clients to position with all of that going on?
There are no no-brainers in this business, but certainly one way to play it is to get an ETF of regional banks, a package. The idea is this asset class isn't going away. Any one bank might have a misstep. You're not quite sure what's in their portfolio, but as a group, they cannot go away. I'm looking here just the worst 20 performers in the S&P 500 for March. 18 of them are banks, and all but one are trading now at single-digit price-earnings ratio when that overall market has moved up from 17 to 18. So, you know, will happen in the next couple of weeks? Who knows? But, you know, why wouldn't, over the next few years, they double or triple?
I hate to be nervous, Nelly, here, but I will point out some of the major average, well, particularly S&P 500, being driven by kind of a narrow band of stocks, right, David? Should I be nervous?
Certainly, I think some of the upside has been taken away. So, for example, the information technology group was trading at a 20 PE at the start of the quarter. Now it's done so well, that price-earnings ratio is at 24. Now, could it go higher? Sure. At the start of last year, it was 28. But here's the problem for the bulls in that type of a bet. Last year, the two-year treasury in the beginning of the year was just 0.75%. Today is over 4%, almost seven times more. And the fact of the matter is you have to moderate your PEs once the competing investments like bonds, interest rates keep going up. So I don't think it's going to go up to 28. So I think it's brought forward some of the gains for the year. And heck, if you could close the year at 15%, 16% of the NASDAQ, why wouldn't you do that? So I probably would be taking some profits from that area and rotating into the healthcare, real estate, financial services area. future.
Okay. Now, how much of the rise do you suppose is predicated on the idea that we're going to see cuts later this year from the Fed?
A lot. You know, it all starts with inflation. And although part of the reason February was so bad is we got a very hot number for January, we just saw this morning a softer than expected PCE deflator inflation number, which apparently is the one that the Fed prefers. So we are gradually seeing a rolling over in inflation. Certainly is much less hot than it was, for example, last summer. It's not going to go in any one direction in a straight line, but it seems to be receding, and that makes sense. We're seeing commodities down. Obviously, with the higher interest rates, real estate is under pressure, auto sales are under pressure, so the economy is cooling. That will allow interest rates to come back down. I mean, at one point, the two-year was over 5, now it's just over 4. That helps. And ultimately, you know, the markets dictate to the Fed what they're going to do. Ultimately, it's not the Fed that tells the markets what's going to happen. And I think ultimately, and we're seeing some signs in the last presser that there may only be one more rate hike, the Fed will be less of a headwind than it was last year. And that's great.
David, what about tech stocks that have been on such a tear this year? How are you positioning in that corner of the market?
So, you know, I think you want to be a little bit more selective because those valuations have moved up, but some may offer still some good opportunities. So, for example, Meta Platforms was one of the best performers, up about 70% in the first quarter, but its price-to-earnings ratio is still under 20. And, of course, you know, Zuckerberg's on a tear. This is the year of efficiency, so he's cutting out all sorts of excess costs, reducing capital expenditures into Meta, moving into AI, and of course it's a unique property with billions of people tuning into their social media platforms every day. And if the economy doesn't go into a hard recession, that social media advertising is going to pick up. That may be something that you want to continue to play, even though it's done so well so far this year.
David from the great state of New Jersey. How are your property taxes, David? Sore subject.
I love New Jersey because I'm so close to New York and you guys. Okay.
I should point out, I'm down at the shore, so. Anyway, consumer discretionary stocks, I should point out, just I don't have any discretion anymore when it comes to consumers. So, anyway, that's the best performer in the S&P 500. David Dietz, the managing principal and senior investment strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management. On the phone from Summit, New Jersey today.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.